You're listening to the Reasonable Faith Virtual Chapter Podcast. In this podcast, you'll hear the audio from one of our live discussions. Please join the discussion at reasonablefaithvirtual.org.
All right, everyone, my name's Simon Williams. Thanks for coming out. Really appreciate you guys showing interest in this topic and just coming out to listen to me talk about the atonement. It's one of the, I think this is one of the most important things that we could possibly look into. So it's really an honor to have been asked by Matt to do this. So today I've been asked to talk about the atonement, and now the atonement is a huge topic, and we certainly will not be able to explore the full extent of it here, but I have been given some questions to help focus the discussion for tonight, and here are those questions. So number one, and you'll see these all in the slides provided, but number one, one person can't pay for another person's wrongdoing, i.e. it's wrong and unjust that the actual sinner doesn't pay for his sins. Number two, if Jesus' sacrifice is efficacious for anyone, the most depraved sinner can be saved, then why isn't it efficacious for everyone? Why doesn't the unlimited power to forgive through Christ's sacrifice not result in an unlimited forgiveness? Why doesn't God forgive... forgot about those slides. Why doesn't God just forgive everyone? Number three, why is it ethical for God to forgive on someone else's behalf? In other words, if Sam wrongs Bill, then why does God get to forgive Sam whether or not Bill wants him to? All right, so in order to better understand a lot of the answers for these challenges, because there's definitely more than one, we need to first understand what it means to forgive. But before we can get into forgiveness, we need to first understand what sin is. After all, if there was no sin, then there would be no need for atonement. The Hebrew word in the Old Testament for sin is hatah, and the Greek word in the New Testament is hamartia. Both words roughly mean to miss the mark. To sin is to miss or wander from the way, or to stumble in the path of morally correct behavior or thinking. What's particularly important to note is that the Bible teaches that we sin against God, of course, but also we sin against our fellow human beings. Some people are surprised to hear that, but sin isn't limited to actions against God. And sin, as actions against our human beings, is actually a common theme throughout the Bible. The very first time we see the word sin is in Genesis chapter 4. Cain is jealous for the favor Abel had won, and God warns Cain, saying, "If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it." And we all know what Cain does to Abel. The sin that God was talking about there manifested itself in Cain's murderous violence against his brother. We also see this concept in the Ten Commandments. The first four commandments are focused on God. Then the remaining six are focused on humans. And again, we all know the many, many laws meant to elaborate on what those commands look like for the Israelites. But even the Ten Commandments are an elaboration on just two commandments. Deuteronomy 6:5, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And Leviticus 19:18, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. Of course, Jesus brings them together succinctly in Luke chapter 10, verse 27, with love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. So what I'm trying to show here is that according to the Bible, missing the mark is best understood as failing to properly love. So what kind of love is this? It is the type of love that God expresses. Many regard love as God's basic attribute, the very nature or definition of God. In general, God's love may be thought of as his eternal sharing and giving of himself. Paul does a great job of defining this type of love in 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient, love is kind, it is not envious, love does not brag, it is not puffed up, it is not rude, it is not self-serving, it is not easily angered or resentful, it is not glad about injustice, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Failing to properly love damages relationships because it causes a separation between the people involved. Complete separation is the ultimate consequence of sin. And as the NET Bible points out, death is essentially separation. To die physically means separation from the land of the living, but not extinction. To die spiritually means to be separated from God. Both occur with sin, although the physical alienation is more gradual than instant, and the spiritual is immediate, although the effects of it continue the separation. Therefore, when God told Adam, "You must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die," he was warning Adam of the consequences of disobeying God. Choosing not to obey God is to choose not to properly love God. And why is that? Part of truly loving someone is respecting their boundaries. When someone establishes a boundary, it is an act of love to respect the boundary, especially when they have consistently proven to have pure intentions and to have abundant wisdom. To doubt that God has good intentions, or that God is withholding something good without a good reason, is to fail to love God. It is to sin against God, and that is what Adam and Eve did in the garden. They doubted that God had good intentions for withholding the fruit, and so failed to love God by disobeying him and damaged their relationship with God. Their actions caused them to be separated from God. In doing what they did, they brought both sin and death into God's perfect world. So when Jesus rebukes the Sadducees, saying, He is not the God of the dead, but of the living, Jesus is making a comment to the status of those individuals' relationship with God. But we all die as a result of our sin. Romans 7:9. So what can an all-powerful and perfectly loving God do to restore his relationship with us? If someone sins against God, God will mediate for him. But if someone sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But if death is a necessary consequence of sin, that means that there is a problem. How does one forgive sins? This is going to sound weird, but someone's going to have to die. And here's why. So what does it mean to forgive? When asked about forgiving people, Jesus responded by giving a parable about a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. You can see this in Matthew chapter 18, verses 23-35. The king demands servant A to pay back a huge debt, but ends up forgiving the servant after he begs for more time. Servant A then demands servant B to pay back a much smaller debt. Servant B begs for more time, but servant A refuses to forgive. Upon hearing about this, the king punishes servant A for not showing the same mercy that the king had given him. So, in the parable, what does the debt represent? The point of the parable is to answer the question regarding forgiveness. Peter's question was specifically, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother when he sins against me?" So the debt that is forgiven is, in the parable, is sin. So what happens when a debt is forgiven? What happens to the money that was spent? When the bank forgives a debt, the money doesn't return to the bank's account. Instead, the bank has taken on the debt itself. Likewise, when God forgives our debt, he takes it on himself. He takes the sin on himself, which, as already mentioned, causes separation from God. Separation from God, from the God of goodness, life, and love. What is amazing is that when God forgives the sin, that separation must still happen. So, who must be separated from God, from the God of goodness, life, and love? As strange as it seems, it must be God. And this is why God must also be multipersonal. The problem is that forgiveness is not the end goal or sole feature of Jesus' sacrifice. The end goal is reconciling humans with their God. There's a lot that goes into reconciliation, but one of the ways that reconciliation is achieved is by the removal of resentment towards an offender through punishment. Under normal conditions, the offender is the one who is punished. However, there are situations in which individuals, I'm still getting used to those slides. However, there are situations in which those individuals who have not committed any wrongdoing are punished for the actions of others. One example of such a situation is when a leader is penalized for the actions of the individuals they are responsible for, especially in cases where leaders willingly take responsibility for the actions of those under their care. I've actually observed this directly while in the Navy. Our crew performed poorly and failed an underway evaluation. Actually, there was more than one, but I won't get into it. During that time, our captain took responsibility for the ship's failures, even though our captain wasn't doing anything wrong. And he was removed as captain as punishment. And we, the crew, were not punished. With all this in mind, let's take a look at the earlier objections and provide some brief responses. So the first one was, let's bring it up, one person can't pay for another person's wrongdoing, i.e. it's wrong and unjust that the actual sinner doesn't pay for his sin. So there are two responses to this based off of what has been said. One, it is unjust, but not wrong that the actual sinner doesn't pay for his sins, because that is part of the nature of forgiveness. So God pays for the sin. He takes on the debt, so the wrongdoer doesn't have to pay anymore. And two, the next response is, person A can pay for person B's wrongdoing if person A can legitimately take responsibility for person B's actions. Then that person can pay for the wrongdoing. So number two, if Jesus' sacrifice is efficacious for anyone, the most depraved sinner can still be saved, then why isn't it efficacious for everyone? Why doesn't the unlimited power to forgive through Christ's sacrifice not result in unlimited forgiveness? Why doesn't God just forgive everyone? So there is scriptural data that supports the notion that God has forgiven everyone, but God's forgiveness is not enough. What must happen is reconciliation. The thing about forgiveness is that in and of itself, forgiveness is not reconciliation. Forgiveness always points towards reconciliation and can be a sufficient condition for reconciliation, but reconciliation is still different. And the status of one's reconciliation with God is tied to their citizenship. Are they citizens of the kingdom of God? As king of the kingdom of God, Jesus can take responsibility for the actions of his citizens. If you are not part of the kingdom of God, then you are not part of the kingdom. Then you are part of the kingdom of sin and death. That is a kingdom that God is going to conquer and utterly destroy. So if you're not in a relationship with God in which Jesus is your king, then he doesn't stand in a legal status to actually be justified in taking responsibility for your actions, because you don't belong to him. And number three, why is it ethical for God to forgive on someone else's behalf? In other words, if Sam wrongs Bill, then why does God get to forgive Sam whether or not Bill wants him to? So the Bible doesn't say that God forgives on someone else's behalf. If Sam wrongs Bill, God can forgive Sam for wronging Bill, even if Bill doesn't forgive Sam, and even if Bill doesn't want God to forgive Sam for wronging him. But God doesn't forgive Sam on Bill's behalf. God's forgiveness is separate. Instead, God commands Bill to forgive Sam. He does this because Bill wanted God's forgiveness and received it. When Bill forgives Sam, that is an act of love. If you don't forgive, then you are failing to love, and therefore what you're really doing is demonstrating who your true master is. And your true master is then sin. So you're really part of the kingdom of sin and death. That's what you're demonstrating. So I really appreciate you guys listening in on me. I wanted to condense this down to 20 minutes to make sure that I could squeeze it in to 20 minutes. This is a huge topic, and there's a lot more that can be said, a lot more. But that's where our discussions get to come in, and we can talk about this more in our group discussion. So I really appreciate you guys letting me speak on this.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Reasonable Faith Virtual Chapter Podcast. If you'd like to join the discussion, please join us at reasonablefaithvirtual.org.